Hey there, it's Lars. Thanks for checking out the Lars Larson podcasting experience, and have a fantastic day.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you on a Wednesday. Glad to take your phone calls and emails and live on the Radio Northwest Network. And while it is outside of the Northwest, we plan to keep you up to date with the latest developments that we hear about from Austin, Texas, where the Austin City Bomber, this young man, 24 years old, who set off the bombs, who placed the bombs, who set the tripwires, who tried to apparently FedEx some of his bombs, that all the damage that he's done, the injury and the death that he's caused, is over at this point. The police say they believe he acted alone. He is dead. He blew himself up. And that is the end of that until we try to figure out what his motivation is going to be. But at this point, we don't know a whole heck of a lot about him. He dropped out of junior college, 24 years old, unemployed, living with two roommates who apparently did not know what he was up to, because at this point, the police say they have no indication that he had any accomplices. So we'll keep you up to date as we find out more about this bomber, this killer, who is himself now dead. I'm glad to take your calls, but I want you to vote in the Twitter poll as well. You can find it at Lars Larson Show and LarsLarson.com on the website. And this is one I've been thinking about for a while. Oregon's child welfare agencies and the child welfare agencies of the state of Washington, I will say right up front, have a tough job. It is probably a thankless job. In some cases, you take children away from families. In many cases, you're taking children away from families who need to have children taken away from them because they are abusing the children, or they're hurting them, or they're starving them, or they're beating them. I mean, all kinds of awful things that adults do to children. And occasionally, they're placing those children into new homes. And occasionally, very occasionally, they make some colossal mistakes. One of them is detailed in a story that came out this week. The agency, the Oregon Child Welfare Agency, has agreed to pay $1.3 million settlement to a girl who was placed with a foster father later accused of sexual abuse. This four-year-old girl was placed into a Gresham home of Gabriel David Wallace and his wife 4 years ago. The lawsuit claims the state certified Wallace as a foster care provider despite observing warning signs that he was a self-identified sex addict. He called himself a sex addict. The suit claims that Wallace abused the girl back in 2014, and the state neglected her safety by placing her in the home. Wallace was charged with rape and six counts of first-degree sexual abuse. He was acquitted of all the charges in June of 2015, and the Oregon Department of Human Services has declined to comment. Have you noticed a trend lately? In almost every state government, and in much of the federal government as well, the officials that we elect to public office, to the legislature, the governors that we elect, the folks we choose to run our governments, the cities and the counties, they have now adopted a stance that they look a whole lot better to the public when they just don't talk to reporters. Now, they employ, at the cost of millions of dollars, public information people whose sole job is to send out press releases and arrange for public appearances to make their bosses look good. They do not have a mandate among public information officers that says it's our job to make sure the public knows what this agency is doing. No, their job is to make their boss look good. Now, if you say, Lars, that's the job of everybody in almost every job, even the guy who works at Les Schwab, you know, changing tires, his job is to make the boss look good. I don't think that should be true in public office. I almost wish we had if we have to have public information officers at all, these are the people that I call and say, will your boss come on the radio and comment? And they've made it their job to find excuses for why the boss will not come on. And it's not just me. I've talked to folks who don't do talk radio. They don't do opinion. They're just reporters. And they'll tell me that it is very rare to be able to get public officials, a sheriff, a mayor, a county commissioner, to actually comment on the record or answer some hard questions. Why? Because oftentimes when they answer hard questions, they end up looking bad. Now, having said that, I think in cases like this, where a state agency or a city agency or a county agency screws up this badly, has to pay out $1.3 million. I'm not saying the payment is wrong. I think this little girl was probably damaged, almost certainly damaged by what was done to her because of the negligence and malfeasance of this state agency. Do you know what's not going to happen? You're not going to see anybody fired. The agency just clams up. And you don't even get the opportunity to ask as a citizen or as a talk show host or as a TV or radio or newspaper reporter. Do you even get the opportunity to say, so when you screwed up and put this little four-year-old girl into the home of a man who raped her, who got fired? Who got demoted? Who lost some paychecks? You never get that answer because the agency just clams up. Because the government never does anything wrong. If you listen to their PR people, government agencies never do anything wrong. I think if I made a mistake one-tenth that size, if I made a mistake that cost my boss $130,000, not $1.3 million, I would be getting a pink slip. I think most of us in the private sector, I'll bet for a lot of you, you make a mistake that costs your boss $1,300 because of your negligence or malfeasance in your job, and you are likely to lose your job. But in government, that's almost never the case. I have people say, well, you know, we have rules and procedures and blah, 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 blah. But do you ever hear about somebody saying, hey, you know that guy who screwed up the bridge or screwed up the tunnel machine in Seattle or screwed up that new highway project and they had to go back and do it over again? Yeah, he lost his job. You hear about it in private industry all the time. Somebody screwed up, they got fired. Try finding that in government. And try finding any evidence that anything happens in government. I'd be willing to bet the DHS didn't do a darn thing to its own employees. You, the taxpayers, lost $1.3 million. The folks who made the screw-up, who actually put that little girl into the hands of the man who would rape her, I'll bet they still have their jobs. I'll bet they keep their pensions. I mean, that's maybe why the Andrew McCabe situation at the FBI is so newsworthy. Here's a guy who actually went out and did dirty deeds for years, got investigated by his own agency, and he got fired, and he missed out on, probably will miss out on, about a decade of pension. He'll still get his pension later on, but he's going to miss out on a decade of payments. That's going to cost him something. But local government, state government, county government, good luck finding that. We'll get to all of that in your phone calls and emails. They're welcome from all over the Northwest. We serve Oregon, Washington, and Idaho with honestly provocative talk radio, and you're welcome to call. And naysayers go to the head of the line at 866-439-5277. Emails go to talk@LarsLarsen.com, and I always start with nonsense.
That makes a lot of sense. A lot of nonsense.
Right. You're bloody well right. You know you got a right to say.
This is the Northwest Nonsense, presented by the Ryan Group, where they guarantee to sell your house in 29 days or less, or they'll buy it. 29andgone.com.
How much longer do we have to sit for this nonsense?
No left-leaning, dead fish rapper bias. No mega TV network liberal agenda. Just the cold hard facts from the outdoors.
The Second Amendment forces and the forces allied against the Second Amendment have introduced a ballot measure for Oregon that would turn hundreds of thousands of citizens into criminals simply for enjoying their civil rights. The ballot measure would force the confiscation of tens of thousands of pistols and rifles now owned by citizens. It says that any semi-automatic rifle or pistol capable of holding more than 10 bullets has to be marched down to your local police station and surrendered or registered, kind of like the Kaiser did in Germany back in the 30s. If you fail to surrender it, well, and you don't register it, you're a felon. You can go to prison. It's a ridiculous measure, and I think its sponsors have a hard haul getting the 100,000 or so signatures to put it on the election ballot. But even if it makes the ballot, I think blue state Oregonians can be amazingly conservative on ballot measures. Just check out the huge results in the votes on gay marriage and driver's licenses in recent years. If you don't fight this measure, then listen carefully for the jackboots on your front porch. You can't take the gun out of Oregon. It's right there in the name.
Insane.
Are you completely insane?
Ridiculous.
They get more and more ridiculous.
Flat out dumb.
You're even dumber than I thought.
Who deserves today's Lars Grill of the Day?
Maybe you're just really, really stupid.
Find out right now. Brought to you by Dan Jones Conveyor Trucks. Rock, granite, topsoil, or sand. Let Dan Jones Conveyor Trucks put it where you want it.
I thought I'd give the grill not to a named person, but let me suggest that this suggests today's grill. Oregon's jobless rate holds steady at 4.1%. Washington State has a similar rate. And yet one person in four is on food stamps and too many are on public assistance when there's a booming economy and good jobs available at good wages. The states could put work requirements for Medicaid, food stamps, and welfare under the law, but so far they will not because the powers that be that don't believe in it. Jeff writes in with today's best email, but you can always send more to talk@LarsLarson.com. Lars, I've sent you email before about how the Reynolds School District is using restorative justice. I just want to follow up. What a load of baloney. In my last email to you about this, I tried to avoid saying it was my wife that's the teacher, but I'm pretty fed up. She keeps telling me not to make waves, and I've tried to respect her wishes. She's been teaching 27 years and is respected by her fellow teachers. The school she teaches is totally out of control. The inmates are running the asylum. Restorative justice has taken away all the tools from teachers to control the classroom. She spends most of her time working to keep control and very little time actually teaching. Thank you very much. I appreciate the email. You can send more emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. Welcome back to the program. Glad to have you with me on the Radio Northwest Network and glad to take your calls in a moment. Kevin Starr joins me now from the only true sole Second Amendment organization that advocates for your Second Amendment rights in the Oregon legislature. In this case, Kevin, welcome back to the program.
Thank you, Lars.
So I gave folks my take on this new initiative petition. I don't know that they'll get the signatures, although if Michael Bloomberg can flush millions of dollars into the region to be able to push it, they probably will get the signatures. Whether or not Oregonians would actually approve what amounts to a demand that people give up their weapons, surrender them for the destruction of those weapons in most cases, whether or not Oregonians will vote for that nonsense, I wanted to get your take on it and what you see in it.
Well, I don't think Oregonians will vote for it, but I think an awful lot of Multnomah County will vote for it, and that might be all they need. I think if you've had an opportunity to actually look at the language of the initiative, it's the product of what happens when you give monkeys alcohol. It's incoherent. It's absolute gibberish. But I don't know that that's necessarily going to make any difference because, as you said, if Bloomberg comes in with $20 million of ads of people, you know, grainy footage of people shooting up schools, then I think, you know, enough people might buy it. But the fact is that this has the potential to pretty much ban virtually any firearm. I mean, it's like I said, much of it doesn't make any sense. There's Section 2, it ends with a letter. It's full of typos.
It's
extremely overreaching. And I think what it does do, though, is it certainly does put the lie to their continued rhetoric that they're not looking to ban guns. If you own a perfectly legal firearm or a magazine, a perfectly legal feeding device, they want to make you a felon. They want you to register magazines, and somehow you have to identify the magazines, which is, of course, impossible.
There's no serial number on them.
Right. And so, you know, I think the effort here is to just turn as many Oregonians into felons as quickly as possible.
Well, let me ask you, though, in the particulars of this thing, I read through it carefully, then read it again. As you say, it's confusing, it's jumbled up. But it appears to say that if it passes and becomes law, let's say it becomes law January 1 of next year, every gun bought before then could, in theory, be kept by somebody if they're willing to go down and submit to this new state registry where you have to register your gun with the state police, go back through a background check that you had to do when you first bought the rifle or pistol, and that it does affect. I mean, the pistol I'm carrying right now only holds 6 rounds because my .45 is literally in the shop, but I said to my producer, it's capable of taking a bigger magazine, and so
exactly.
So that makes it illegal. And I'm supposed to register this with the state, but I don't live in the state of Oregon. I live in the state of Washington. So would I be breaking the law if I came into the state with a gun that's not registered with the state I don't live in?
Well, I think you would be. I mean, the ballot measure has language that if you move into the state and own these things, you have to turn them over to the police. You know, I mean, there are people, first of all, there are an awful lot of people. I've been answering emails since 7 o'clock this morning, hundreds of them. There's an awful lot of people who are confused and think that this is a bill. It's not a bill.
No.
It's a ballot measure. People need to understand that. People are very angry at legislators, but legislators aren't behind this. You know, some folks from the, quote, faith community are behind this. Interestingly, a rabbi is promoting this. I mean, I guess this guy, you know, didn't read anything about what happened in Germany in the 30s. But the fact is, Lars, if a person takes a position that I'm okay because I registered it, then they have to look back at, you know, when I left New York, they had a firearms registry. And if you needed a license to buy a rifle and you had to register rifles with the police. When I left New York, I got a letter forwarded to me that was sent to my address in New York and forwarded to me and said, we know you own these rifles, turn them in. So anybody who thinks that they're safe because they registered with the Gestapo is sadly mistaken. The fact is this is a massive gun ban, and it is, I mean, granted, it's extremely poorly written, but it is far beyond anything I've ever seen elsewhere.
Well, and in fact, the law, as I read it, said that if you bought one before the effective date, if the law goes into effect, if it makes the ballot, if the voters vote for it, that you can keep it if you register it. However, the only thing you can do with it is keep it in your home. You can drive it to the gun range and shoot it there, and then you can take it back. You are not allowed to take it anywhere else, which is very different from the current status, where if I wanted to go down to the state capitol and stand in front of the state capitol building with a semi-automatic rifle on a sling in plain view, I can do that. You would not be able to do that then. You would not be able to take it anywhere except to a gun store or a gun range and then take it right back to your house. And that so even if you're allowed by the state to exercise your Second Amendment rights, your right to keep and bear, they're telling you that you can't do much with it after that.
Well,
right?
And then you don't have Second Amendment rights, because obviously the Second Amendment doesn't say you can go to a range. That's not what it's talking about. But it's so clear that this is basically an attempt to ban the private ownership of virtually any firearm. And granted, whoever wrote this, I mean, some of it is just frankly gibberish. You know, whoever wrote it has no idea what they're talking about. But it's so badly written that it could be interpreted to ban. There's almost nothing it can't ban.
Well, wheel guns. They can't ban a revolver under this, right?
You know, I'm not so sure about that.
Oh, really?
I think that we've been trying to figure out what it actually does mean, and, you know, no two people seem to agree that what it actually means. I mean, they're talking about having threaded barrels that accept pistol grips, you know, things that don't exist, just crazy stuff. But, look, you know, this is not really a surprise. It's interesting that the Democratic politicians haven't said anything about it.
No.
They do think that it has a potential to have a massive effect on the elections.
I know I'm coming up on a break, Kevin, but I hope that OFF will be out on the front lines fighting this thing, right?
You can rest assured.
And, Kevin, I'm going to be asking all my friends in television, are you going to ask Governor Kate Brown what is her position on this confiscatory proposal? And we've got to keep pressing her till she gives an opinion. Thanks a lot, Kevin. I appreciate it. You've got the Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. Glad to be with you and glad to take your calls. All over the Northwest, we supply honestly provocative talk radio. And one of the questions that kind of provoked me after reading Katie Shepard's story at WWeek.com is, we owe, I guess, a debt if we have people that we hold in custody because they're accused of crimes or convicted of crimes. We have to provide them with proper care. The question is, what constitutes proper care? And that's what Katie's story is about. Katie, how are you?
I'm good.
So what? There are people who died in this story because what? Because the corrections department didn't do its job or what?
Well, it's hard to say that Tina Ferry died because of the corrections officials' actions, but her death may have been prevented if they had acted differently. She got the flu in January during a widespread outbreak in Coffee Creek Correctional Facility, and she ended up getting pneumonia in both of her lungs and succumbing to organ failure because of that infection. And what the correction staff failed to do is vaccinate the majority of inmates in that prison. They only vaccinated 1 in 5 of the women there.
Why?
The Oregon Department of Corrections didn't really give me an explanation as to why they vaccinate so few. They say that they prioritize people who have pre-existing health conditions that make their immune systems vulnerable to the flu, and people over the age of 65, which are generally recognized as the people most at risk to die from the flu.
Mm-hmm.
But it is CDC's recommendation that everybody older than 6 months gets the flu shot, and the Federal Bureau of Prisons guidelines say that all inmates should be offered a flu shot. The Oregon Department of Corrections actually told me that their policy is to offer the flu shot to every inmate, but this year and last year, they failed to inform the women at Coffee Creek that they could get a flu shot for free.
Well, so she could have had a flu shot.
They would have given her one if she asked for it, but they didn't tell her or the majority of other inmates in the prison that they could even ask.
So, in other words, if anything, we're faulting the DOC for not over-explaining to a 53-year-old woman that she could get a flu shot if she merely asked for it?
Well, they didn't inform her in any way that they even had the flu shot in the facility.
Well, I mean, are inmates generally aware that there is a clinic to deal with any of their medical needs? And there is, isn't there?
They know that they can request medical treatment if they need it.
Okay, so she knew she could request medical treatment. She didn't think to ask for it. Any other reasons that she might have become this ill? And I'm tempted to ask, what was she in for?
So she was serving a 70-month sentence on a Measure 11 assault charge after she crashed her car into three other cars and a man who was involved in the accident injured his arm. And she was also convicted on a possession of methamphetamine charge.
So she had been a meth user. I don't know that much about meth, never having used it myself, but most of the people who use meth smoke it?
I don't know.
Well,
I don't know how she was using it.
Well, I mean, if you smoke methamphetamine, I have to believe it probably isn't good for your lungs. And she died of pneumonia, which is an illness of the lungs. The two might be related.
It's possible. But there's a good shot that if she had gotten the vaccine, that the impact of getting the flu would have been mitigated. If you get the vaccine and you still get sick with the flu, you're 5 times less likely to die.
Okay, and we don't even know for a fact that she would have asked for the shot if she had known about it, or do we know that?
Her family says that they grew up getting the flu shot their whole lives, and they knew her to be a person who would get the flu shot if it was offered to her.
Even after she was a meth addict? Okay.
She didn't have any objections to that.
Okay. Well, I mean, the reason I ask that is, how long had she been in jail at this point when she became ill?
She was in Coffee Creek for 3 months.
3 months. So she'd been there long enough to see people come and go from the clinic, and maybe even if 1 in 5 persons got the flu shot. I guess I'm just wondering, where does the state's responsibility begin and end? I mean, it's one thing to say we have to provide medical care. They did. We have to offer medical options. They did. How much do they have to educate the average inmate to sit them down and explain, these are all the things that are available for you. Do you want them? Is that the expectation we should have when somebody's held in custody?
What is the Oregon Department of Corrections policy that they do more than just have the vaccine available? They are supposed to issue announcements to inmates, letting them know that the flu shot is now available this year, and giving them instructions on how to request it. They do that at other prisons. They did that at other prisons this year. They did not do that at Coffee Creek in 2017 or 2016. In other state prison systems, they do a lot more than that. So in California, for example, they have a health professional meet with every single inmate and talk to them about the flu vaccine, and they show them educational videos about the benefits and potential risks of that.
They should actually have to market it to them. When you said that they usually do offer it, you also say in your story they have no written policy on flu vaccine, but they do recommend that all inmates get it. If they have no written policy, I don't know how you determine that they usually or should be offering it or have offered it in the past if they have no policy.
Well, that's what they told me, and it's also apparent in public records that they shared with me, sharing the announcements to inmates in previous years and at other prisons.
Okay. Do they plan to make any changes in how they do this? And were they shortchanging on, if you think they've shortchanged this woman on flu vaccine, were they shortchanging to save money or what?
So the response that I got from the Department of Corrections is that the lack of an announcement in the past 2 years at Coffee Creek was an oversight, that it was an unintentional oversight in terms of reaching out to inmates. I do not know at this time whether they plan to make any changes to how they approach this issue, but it's possible that they would either go back to what they were doing previously in 2015 and in years prior to that.
By the way, I'm talking to Katie Shepherd. You can find her story at WWeek.com. There's the argument is made, well, maybe her life would have been spared if she'd had the flu shot. Katie, I get the flu shot every year, and I recommend it as well. I also got the flu this year because the flu shot was notoriously ineffective this year. CDC said it was ineffective. They said maybe it kept a third of the people who got the shot from getting the flu. The other two-thirds got the full-blown deal, and I know I did. So in that case, even if she'd had the shot, she had, you know, one chance in three that it would have kept her from getting more ill and ending up with pneumonia that finally killed her.
Well, even in years when the vaccine is incredibly ineffective, the vaccine, not getting the shot, makes you twice as likely to get sick. And if you do get sick, but you have previously had the vaccination, you're five times less likely to die of complications. So that's a pretty big increase if you do get the flu. If you don't have the vaccine, you're five times more likely to die.
By the way, it doesn't say so that I can find in your story, but is Ms. Ferry's family suing over this?
Yeah, that is in the story, actually, that they're considering legal action against the Department of Corrections for the treatment that their mother received when she started reporting that she was feeling very ill, and for not offering her the flu shot proactively.
So when they say they're considering it, they're thinking about asking for millions of dollars in compensation because Tina Ferry died while in custody for committing a Measure 11 crime.
They're seeking legal action. I don't know the details of what that would look like.
Very good. Katie, thanks a lot for bringing us up to date on this.
Thank you for having me on.
Glad to have you on. Katie Shepherd from WWeek.com. So what do you think? If the prison or the jail, in this case, Coffee Creek Correctional Facility, the prison, has inmates, do they have to be afforded medical care? I would say that's undoubtedly a yes under the Constitution. Do they have to talk the inmates into taking a flu shot, which is a preventative measure, and do more to talk to tell them about the availability and not just count on the inmate to ask for it if needed? And should an inmate's family get compensation in the hundreds of thousands or millions of dollars because she got the flu and died of pneumonia? You're listening to the Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. By the way, I'm going to be in the Tri-Cities of Washington on Friday to do First Amendment Friday live with our local affiliate, KONA, and we'll be doing it from the Moore Mansion, and then a little get-together that night, maybe a breakfast the next morning. It should be a lot of fun. I like the Tri-Cities, and I'm always glad to go on the road and get out of the studio, get away from these guys. And these guys stare at me through a window like I'm a monkey or something, or I'm in a Petri dish. The other thing I'm doing tonight, left hook, right jab with the left hook, Steve Novick, and the right jab, that's me. And we're going to be debating, you know, they're going to have another protest, another march by the kids, even though David Hogg seems to be rapidly running through his 15 minutes of fame. This is the young man from the school in Parkland, Florida, who's making a lot of time on television, doesn't have any real specific proposals, but Steve and I are going to debate that and what our advice to these young Americans would be. I've got some advice for them. Let's go to Joe, first of all. Hey, Joe, welcome to the Lars Larson Show on the Radio Northwest Network. What's on your mind? Hello, Joe. All right. Well, we'll go to Michael in Bellingham. Hey, Michael, thanks for listening on KGMI. What's on your mind today?
Hey, Lars, how are you?
I'm doing quite well today. You heard us talking about this inmate, Tina Ferry, who died from pneumonia that came following her case of the flu, which came after she failed to ask for a flu shot, which apparently she could have asked for. The story detailed at WWeek.com. You've got a perspective on this?
Well, I do have a perspective, and I would like to remind listeners of a story that happened out of Snohomish County with a young man who was arrested for marijuana possession and sentenced to serve one day in jail. He notified everybody that he had a peanut allergy. And the next morning, he started having some kind of an allergic reaction, and it took over an hour of 12 inmates beating on windows and doors in order to get the attention of somebody just to receive the medical attention. And I think that is something, having personally spent a few days in jail previously myself with the DUI, unfortunately, I have witnessed firsthand people be denied necessary medical attention by the state in these situations. I honestly think that we treat animals at the Humane Society better sometimes than we treat our fellow human beings in jail.
Well, let me ask you something. If you beat on the walls in your house, how long would it take for a member of your family to come to find out what was going wrong?
Well, there should be a little bit of a, you would think, observation and a correction.
No, hold on. Just please answer my question. You're not in jail now, right?
No, not at all.
Do you beat on the walls very often or beat on the windows very often in your own home?
I certainly don't.
And if you did it, somebody would think something's wrong because I hear somebody hammering on the wall. How often do inmates engage in the beating on the walls and the doors in jail?
I'm certain that they do so sometimes often.
You think very often and often enough that when they beat on the walls and the windows and the doors, that the corrections officers, if they were to check every time somebody was beaten on the walls, they'd be down there all the time. So I guess one of the reasons that guards didn't respond more quickly is that they do it all the time, which creates a problem, right?
Well, that's understandable as well.
Yeah.
I just don't think that they give the level of medical attention or care that some inmates would require or need.
I was waiting for you to say that. Now, tell me what level of inmate care do you think inmates should expect? Because I'm constantly hearing about all the new things that we have to do for inmates. I want them to be treated humanely, but how far do we go? I mean, I understand that some correction systems are now saying we have to do transgender surgery and transgender hormone treatment. Maybe if you've got a finite amount of money to take care of the medical needs of inmates and somebody decides they've got to have a $10,000 or $20,000 surgery or a few thousand dollars worth of hormone treatments to change from being a man to a woman, you have less money to spend on flu shots. Is that possible?
That's absolutely 100% correct. And I think, you know, that's an example of it being a little egregious. I think the example that we're talking about today with the story, I don't think it's the state's responsibility to, you know, publicly notify each and every inmate what's available to them. So I do agree with you on that. I don't think that there's a really solid case, but I will say that I do believe a lot of times they are ignored and the medical, you know, they say that when you go to jail, you're going to get 3 hots and a cot and some good medical treatment. And I would challenge anybody that ever says that to actually go there for a few days and see if that's really.
I don't need to go there to know that we spend a lot of money on that. And here's one thing I want to mention. Do you ever get the flu shot?
I do not get the flu shot.
I do get the flu shot. Do you ever have friends who do get the flu shot mentioned? Hey, I got my flu shot today, or I got my flu shot, but I'm feeling a little ill a week later. Do people ever say things like that to you?
Absolutely.
So this young lady who died of pneumonia, Tina Ferry, was in an institution for 3 months where you live in very close quarters with a whole bunch of people you don't know all that well. And a third of them got flu shots, but she wasn't aware you could get a flu shot by just asking for it. Does that beg credulity just a little bit that you're living in all these close quarters? You've got nothing to do but time on your hand to talk about whatever's going on. A third of the inmates have had flu shots. Some may be getting sick. And they say, well, I'm getting sick, but I had my flu shot a month ago. Oh, how'd you get that? And I'm wondering, the fault that's being found with the DOC is they didn't come down and tell Tina Ferry, by the way, if you want a flu shot, all you have to do is ask for it. Do you think she might have learned that just from her roommates?
No, I think she could have learned that from her roommates, and I don't think it was the state's responsibility to administer the flu shots to everybody because it's not economically feasible. I think their policy of restricting that only to inmates that are over 65 or have previous conditions.
Not a bad idea.
You know, a good one.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. I'll get back to your phone call shortly at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. But joining me now, Dr. Sebastian Gorker, former advisor to President Donald Trump, New York Times bestselling author of Defeating Jihad, and a national security strategist for Fox News. How you doing, Doc?
Very well, very well. Sitting in the swamp looks much better when it's covered in snow. That's the reality.
It actually improves the looks of Washington, D.C., doesn't it?
It does. It does.
Well, and in fact, I noticed that the nation's capital kind of shuts down. I think the president canceled some of his schedule.
It's hilarious. We get 1 inch and everybody runs for the hills. I really hope nobody invades after we get an inch of snow, because I tell you, that's when you want to invade with D.C.
not that anybody is suggesting that. I know there's a bunch of things we want to talk to you about today in the short time we have, but let me start with this. President Trump congratulated President Putin on this sham of an election that the Russians hold. Is there really any problem with the president doing this, considering that President Obama did the very same thing when he was president?
The problem is, as you rightly indicate, the double standards of the left-wing media. But more importantly, the problem is the White House had to issue a statement today that it is a fireable offense and illegal to leak memos that were written for the president. How is it that we are in, you know, the year of our Lord 2018, and people have to be told that it is wrong to do that? It's outrageous. I mean, what does it mean that the most powerful man in the world cannot have a conversation with his peers, whether it's the Prime Minister of Australia or even Vladimir Putin, without that being disclosed to the media? That's outrageous, Lars.
Dr. Gorka,
whatever he said.
I know you don't work in the White House anymore, but I've had some of my colleagues say, why is it there are all these people who hate Donald Trump who are still working in and around the White House? And I said, probably because you can't walk in and just fire 1,300 or 13,000 people right off the bat and effectively replace them. But is there a better way to understand why it is that people who work for the president, work within the White House or in the old executive office building, and their job is to serve the president of the United States in whatever he decides is, you know, in doing his work to serve the American public, that these people apparently are willing to sabotage the president, as you suggest, by leaking or by, you know, by putting out bad information or good information? Why is it all these people are still around? Why haven't they been given their walking papers?
Well, very simply, because you have to understand, on January the 20th, 2017, the president and his close circle, myself included, executed the most leveraged hostile takeover in the history of the United States. It was a very small group of people that came into the building. And most of the people that work in the White House, in the NSC, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people, they're actually GS employees. They're government employees. And why do they do what they do? Because they think they have the right to decide things in the opposite direction of the president's own objectives. I saw this again and again and again at the National Security Council. I saw senior-ranking individuals at the State Department, CIA, DOD, and elsewhere, who simply acted as if there hadn't been an election and Barack Obama or Hillary was the commander-in-chief. So that's the motivation. And the good news is, Lars, the president is unstoppable, and it's going to be another 7 years of Donald J. Trump and then 8 years of President Pence.
I'm certainly looking forward to it. Let me talk about a couple of other issues. Is Attorney General Sessions going to let the other McCabes off the hook, or is he going to try to restore faith? I mean, he did a lot for himself by firing McCabe, as the Office of Professional Responsibility recommended, but is he going to take action against some of the other folks who've done things that are antithetical to the best interests of Americans?
Well, it sounds like you've read my piece from yesterday, Hill, the Hill.com, and that's exactly my message. So the Attorney General, an honorable man, a good man, the first senator to endorse candidate Trump, now is the test. McCabe is, although he rose to the rank of deputy director of the FBI, he's only one cog in this massively corrupt conspiracy that includes people like Peter Strzok, Lisa Page, James Comey himself, Clapper, you know, the former director of the CIA, John Brennan. It is a Stygian stables, and the AG now has to clear those stables. McCabe is just the beginning, and now comes the real test of Jeff Sessions. Let's wait and see what he produces.
Well, Dr. Gorka, let me put it this way. What was it that General Flynn was prosecuted for specifically? What was he prosecuted for?
Lying to a federal agent.
Now, do you think that Andrew McCabe and James Comey both lied to federal agents in their own agency or lied to Congress under oath, which is perjury, isn't that? Didn't they both do that?
We know that. We know that. Not only that, John Brennan lied under oath, perjured himself in front of Congress as well. These are individuals that have leaked constantly to the press, to the media. These are individuals who should all be investigated, and if the evidence is adequate, should be charged with the crimes they have committed. I don't care if your name is Comey and you are the former director of the FBI. Either the statue of justice is blindfold or it isn't, and now we will find out if we have rule of law in the American Republic.
Dr. Sebastian Gorka is with me, former advisor to President Donald Trump, now national security strategist for Fox News. Is there, do you have some sense today of what it is that's holding Sessions back? I mean, does somebody have pictures of him that are embarrassing or what? Because it seems as though this guy was always hardcore, straight to the facts. As a United States senator, he gave no quarter when it came to demanding from federal agencies, this is what we are entitled to. And yet now he's in charge of one, and it seems as though he's become a bit of a wallflower, other than the McCabe decision, which I think was an easy one because it was really made by the FBI and its OPR and not by him. So what's holding him back?
You know what's holding AG Sessions back?
What?
The fact that this brave man decided to take on the Vipers then that is the DOJ. I'm not here to make excuses for the Attorney General, but the Obama administration politicized every arm of federal government, from the CIA to the FBI to the IRS, as we now know. Lars, they politicized the Park Service. Do you remember when we had the government shutdown and Obama sent the park rangers to block off the national monuments from the veterans that were visiting them? Every branch of government was politicized like a banana republic. But guess which was the worst? The Department of Justice, an utter viper's den of political ideologues and hacks. And that's the job that Attorney General Sessions took upon himself. So you wouldn't want that job, Lars. Nobody would. So have patience and have faith in the AG and the president.
Well, I hope you're right about that. I know I wouldn't want that job. I'm not an attorney, so I couldn't do the job anyway. But even if I had the job, I might take out some of my frustrations by saying, who is it around here has broken the law the last time? Oh, I know, Comey. Let's go to a federal grand jury, and let's get James Comey indicted. And that'll send a message. And then after that, we'll indict Andrew McCabe, and he'll think the loss of a few years of pension is the least of his problems. And then we're going to go after a few more people after that. I would think that he'd be doing, and maybe it's all going to come in a rush at some point, but it's been a while.
People will be indicted, and people will be prosecuted for the crimes they have been committed.
Dr. Gorka, it's always a pleasure to have you on the program. Thanks so very much for taking the time today.
Thanks, Lars. God bless you and the listeners.
Take care now. Dr. Sebastian Gorka at Fox News, former advisor to the president, New York Times bestselling author of Defeating Jihad. If you want to join the best conversation in talk journalism, it's right here at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. You can send emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. You can answer our Twitter poll at Lars Larson Show. And you're listening to The Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to The Lars Larson Show. Glad to have you with me. The latest we know out of Austin, Texas, is that the young man, Mark Anthony Condit, 23 years of age, lived in Pflugerville, Texas. That's about 20 miles from downtown Austin. He was found today at a hotel in Round Rock, Texas. And as you know, the police were waiting for what they call a ballistic vehicle to arrive. In other words, probably a Bearcat or similar that would have allowed officers to approach without getting shot themselves. He then left the hotel before that vehicle arrived. The police followed him in a vehicle. He ditched the vehicle and then blew himself up in a ditch off I-35. He described himself as a nerd. He was unemployed. His last job was with an engineering and manufacturing company. And he was behind the bombings that killed Anthony House, that killed Draylen Mason, that critically injured 75-year-old Esperanza Herrera. And a reward was offered before he was caught of up to $115,000 to find him. The bombing appears to have stopped, but you know the concern right now is that Mark Anthony Condit, now dead by blowing himself up, may have put other bombs in the mail or in FedEx delivery or some other form of delivery, and that those bombs could still be out there, and they are watching for that right now. To your calls at 866-HEY-LARS. Let's go first to Dave in Puyallup. Hey, Dave, thanks for listening on Talk Radio 570 KVI. What's on your mind?
Hey, Lars. I just wanted to say two things about this lady that died in prison with the flu.
Yep, died from the flu. Actually, she had pneumonia, and her family now says they should have given her, they should have made it clear to her she could get a flu shot just by asking for it. What do you think?
Absolutely ridiculous. Number one, most likely, if she wasn't incarcerated in prison, do you think she would seek out the flu shot?
As a meth addict, probably not, would be my guess.
Probably not. They're not the model of health. Number two, anyone that's in prison, I don't want to generalize, but I see the majority of people smoke in prison. Smokers have I don't know what the statistic is, but the likelihood of dying from pneumonia is so much greater for smokers.
By the way, this is one of the reasons I ask the young reporter, Katie Shepherd, who's always fun to talk to because sometimes I ask her questions she can't answer. I had asked her, well, if she used methamphetamine, there are a couple of ways to use it. But as I understand it, the most common way is to smoke it, to heat it up in a glass pipe and smoke it. I have a feeling that doesn't do any favors for your lungs. And without being a doctor, would I guess that things that are injurious to your lungs might make you more susceptible to pneumonia? I would guess that's probably true. I mean, I understand that, as you say, smokers are more susceptible to pneumonia, so chances are methamphetamine smokers are more susceptible to it. And I really hope that the Department of Corrections does not write her family a big check. I'm sick and tired of that happening.
Yeah, absolutely. It's just the most ridiculous thing I've ever heard.
Well, thank you very much. Those were some good comments. I appreciate the call. Let's go to Tom in Port Angeles. And Tom, you heard me talking to Dr. Sebastian Gorka about this issue of Vladimir Putin winning an election. He won an election the way Castro used to win elections, and that was he was guaranteed to win, and Donald Trump congratulated him. Was he wrong to do so?
Well, first I want to thank you for having Sebastian Gorka on as much as you do. That guy's a good voice for us. But as far as the Russian election for Putin, it might be legitimate. And what I back that up with is, as East looks West, they've been witnessing all the same slippery slopes that we've been going down. And, geez.
Well,
I just can't help but feel that if the election might be legitimate,
you just made me think of something, because occasionally I realize I'm a hypocrite on some issues, and I may have been a hypocrite on this, because in the past I think we were always able to say, well, Castro doesn't have legitimate elections, and Venezuela doesn't, and Russia and China don't, but we do here in America. But as you point out, we've had a lot of shenanigans in our election, and in fact, if Hillary Clinton had won in November of 2016, would we be able to say, if we knew the things that were done to Bernie Sanders by his own party, that that was a legitimate election where a legitimate candidate was denied a fair shot and came very close to getting the nomination anyway? I mean, if she had not torpedoed him using the power of the party and money and everything else, if she had not cheated him out of opportunities, if she didn't have Donna Brazile sneaking her debate questions and things like that, was Hillary Clinton a legitimate nominee of the Democrat Party? I'd have to say no. So maybe when we are all looking at other countries, and I'm including myself in this, saying, well, their elections aren't real, they're fake. Well, ours are a bit, at least on the D side, are a little bit fake as well.
Well, it depends on how much the Russians know and how accurate it is. But, certainly as we look down the last, since the 60s, or even before, since the 60s, this nation's been normalizing a whole bunch of stuff that's absolutely abhorrent to a lot of the rest of the people of the world. And it wouldn't surprise me at all if, Vladimir Putin could go ahead and put up all the ballots. But, I really doubt it, because You just can't go out jailing your opponents, That's out.
No, right? although if Hillary Clinton had the opportunity to put Donald Trump in jail, do you think she would have hesitated to do it? Come on,
Hillary Clinton at all, or anything associated with that family.
I think she would have done anything she could have to win. She just didn't have it. Let's go to Jaden. Hey, Jaden, welcome to the Lars Larson Show. Glad you're with us on the Radio Northwest Network. What's on your mind?
I was just curious on what your opinion is on this new bill or act being introduced that's going to potentially ban assault weapons, AR-15, pistol grip, high capacity mag. In light of recent events going on with everything in the news, does it have more merit this time around?
No.
And we should be a little bit more concerned about? Okay.
No. Well, but look, let's say what it is first. It's an initiative petition proposal. Now, they have to get over 100,000 signatures of registered voters in the state of Oregon to be able to get it on the ballot. And once it's on the ballot, the voters will have to vote on it to decide whether or not to make it law. So that's what it is. It is not a law. It's not a bill. It's an initiative petition. Secondly, do I think it's more valid? No, because I don't think that banning the sale of new AR-15s and then confiscating rifles, semi-automatic rifles and semi-automatic pistols from legitimate law-abiding owners is a way to solve that problem at all. It wouldn't have made a darn bit of difference in Florida, I think.
Oh, I totally agree with you with that 100%. I'm a gun owner myself, and I was just wondering if it's, you know, usually during times like this, there's a big upsale in firearm purchases due to kind of fear of stuff being confiscated. And so I just got a link from a family member on this one talking about this. So I just made me worried if it did ever come to a point where they were going to come and confiscate, if that's looking like the near future.
So, I don't think so. And in some ways, I kind of would like to see it make the ballot. In some ways, because I think Oregonians would vote it down solidly, and then we'd be able to say, you want to ban those things? No. The voters have already spoken on that, just as we've spoken on illegal alien driver's licenses, just as we've spoken on sales taxes south of the Columbia River. No, we've spoken on that. We don't need to decide it again. You've got the Lars Larson Show. Joe, it's a pleasure to be with you, and I'm glad to get to your phone calls and emails a bit later at 866-439-5277. Emails go to talk@larslarson.com, and it is a real pleasure to welcome to the program the Surgeon General of the United States of America, Doctor or Professor and Vice Admiral Jerome Adams. How are you, sir?
I'm well. It's good to be here, Lars.
You are the Vice Admiral of the Public Health Corps, right?
Absolutely. The Public Health Service is one of seven uniformed services in addition to the Army, Navy, Air Force, Marines, Coast Guard, and NOAA. And we are very pleased to protect and promote the nation's health.
And you're a medical doctor, and your background's in anesthesiology and palliative care, taking care of people's pain needs. So you're right on point when it comes to this opioid epidemic, aren't you?
Well, Lars, unfortunately, I've seen this evolve through many different lenses. I teach to future doctors acute and chronic pain management, and I grew up in the era of pain as the fifth vital sign, where we were told opioids weren't addictive. I also was at the helm in Indiana during that unfortunate HIV outbreak related to injection drug use. And you may know that personally, my own brother is incarcerated right now. He's in prison. He stole $200 to support his addiction habit and was given a 10-year prison sentence.
So you have a very personal connection to all this as well. So what I want to know what you think. You work for the President of the United States, but the President has proposed a new plan to go after this. We can talk about the death penalty later. That's maybe a side issue because it's not specifically a medical issue, but more of a law enforcement issue. But what do we do as a country to address something that's killing more than 60,000 Americans every year through overdoses?
Well, the most important thing is that we talk about it. Unfortunately, far too many communities, over 50% of the American public, still doesn't believe that the opioid epidemic rises to the level of an emergency in their communities. But I'll tell you, I've gone all around the country. I've been with the president, and we just keep hearing heartbreaking story after heartbreaking story. It is happening in your communities. Folks need to be aware. They need to talk to their children about the dangers of opioids. They also need to understand that it's a chronic disease and not a moral failing, because as long as we look at it as simply a moral failing, we will never be able to help folks come forward with for the help they need.
Vice Admiral Adams, I want to ask you this because I'm a bit frustrated by some of the coverage of this as well. Not only the fact that it's not being talked about, but it's characterized as largely the fault of the pharmaceutical companies. Now, I don't have a dog in the fight there, no friends who work there or stocks that I own in those things. But I've also talked to law enforcement people who say the best medical studies around say about 75% of the people who die from overdoses are people who were never on pharmaceutical drugs, either as the beginning of their addiction or to further their addiction. Some of them, of course, have bought illegally bought pharmaceuticals over the counter. But it's characterized in stories as this is all the fault of the doctors and the pharma companies. But it sounds like an awful lot of it, the medical studies show, is the fault of people taking street drugs. Can you straighten that one out for me?
Well, we do know that 4 out of 5 people who use heroin report having initially started with a prescription opiate. Now, as you mentioned, that prescription opiate is not often their own prescription opiate, but it still came about as a result of overprescribing. I have to admit to you, Lars, that again, as an acute pain management and chronic pain management expert myself, we were part of this problem. The pharmaceutical companies were part of this problem. The law enforcement community took a while to recognize the severity of this epidemic and how it was occurring. But in talking with the president, what both he and I are focused on is not placing blame, but making sure everyone, including your listeners, including law enforcement, including doctors and the pharmaceutical company, play a role in helping us dig out from what is truly an epidemic.
Well, I think that'd be desirable to stop those 60,000 deaths every year. It's more deaths than most other categories of death, unless you count heart disease and, I guess, lung cancer. But let's talk about how we do that. Only one in five who suffers one of these addictions gets any kind of treatment, as you point out. Here's the problem. What do we do when people who don't want to get off the drugs are not often very successful in treatment? And even those who've sought some kind of treatment, the treatment, I've been told by the treatment folks, maybe works a quarter of the time. And the other 75% of the time, you can go through a course of treatment and you're right back on the addictive drug. So how do we get people to want to be off of it? And if, and for those who want to continue with their addiction, what do we do with them? Because if they don't want to quit the drug, they're probably, even treatment isn't likely to fix it. Am I wrong about that?
You bring up several important points. And number one, we've got to take advantage of touch points, Lars. You never know when someone is going to hit their rock bottom, going to hit their point when they want to turn things around. And it's why the president was in New Hampshire just earlier this week talking to folks at the fire station there. They have a safe station program where if you decide today is the day I want help, you can come into the fire station, no blame, and they will connect you to care and to support. It's also why the law enforcement community is so important. And folks have gotten on me, if I'll be honest with you, Lars, about how much I'm engaging the law enforcement community. But they see these patients, they see these victims way more often than what any medical professionals do, and they are a critical partner, and we need to take advantage of that arrest point, of that intervention point, in order to connect people to care. Finally, you probably know that one of the things I'm known for is helping start up a syringe service program in Southern Indiana. And while every community needs to decide what's right for them, I think it's important that we discuss using all sorts of different opportunities as a touch point to connect people to care. In Scott County, Indiana, we were able to connect over 200 people to addiction and recovery support services through the syringe service program we set up there.
All right. The thing that makes a lot of us uncomfortable, though, I live in a city, it's a very liberal city, Portland, Oregon. They give out clean needles, which I guess can somewhat ameliorate the problem of hepatitis C and all the rest of these AIDS that are spread by injectable drugs and dirty needles. But on the other hand, the parks literally have thousands, in some cases tens of thousands, of dirty needles in them, because when you hand out the needles, the addict isn't necessarily putting them in a sharps box at the end of his session. What do we do about that problem?
Well, when we started up the syringe service program in Scott County, Indiana, that was a big concern. And I sat down with the sheriff, I sat down with the local police chief, and we said, look, if we're going to do this in our community, we're going to do it in a way that helps clean up the streets. And so we had community cleanup days. We also handed out sharps boxes to the individuals who were getting clean syringes. And we worked with police so that folks weren't worried about getting arrested. That's one of the big fears when you actually talk to people who are using. They don't want to throw their dirty needles away, but they're worried about getting arrested. So if we can create an environment where they bring needles back in, we can help clean up the streets. And we've seen that in Indiana. The science shows, Lars, it's important to note that simply handing out needles does prevent spread of hepatitis and HIV. But for me personally, in my community, if there's going to be a syringe service program, I want it to offer a full array of services, including connections to addiction and recovery support services, including bringing back syringes and cleaning up the community.
I'm talking to the United States Surgeon General, Vice Admiral Jerome Adams. Doctor, tell me this. There are some communities like King County, Washington, that's where Seattle is, that want to have safe injection sites where users could literally go in and inject heroin. I'm not crazy about the idea. You're the doctor. Is it a good idea for cities to set up places where people can safely use illegal drugs with, you know, the sponsorship of the local government?
Well, here's the science on that issue. There have been examples in Europe and now increasingly in the United States where that's been used to successfully lower the number of overdoses and connect people to care. That said, I'm not one to try to tell communities what to do. I think from a public health point of view, we need to help folks understand the full array of harm reduction services that are available. On one end of the spectrum, that syringe safe injection sites. On the other extreme, it's simply raising awareness about the dangers of addiction. And in between, you've got discussions about condoms. You've got discussions about syringe service programs. I just want every community to have a conversation about what is right for them and what the science shows in order to protect themselves and the people in their community from addiction. In some communities, that's going to be a safe injection site. In other ones, it's not. And I'm okay with that as long as we've had the conversation.
Admiral Adams, you've been very generous with your time. One more question, if you don't mind. You mentioned the intersection of law enforcement and medicine. They don't intersect all that often. But I've been told by law enforcement folks, if we can, you know, arrest somebody, charge them, put them in front of a judge, and the judge says, look, I'll erase this felony conviction in a year if you'll get in a treatment program, that's often effective as a way of having them hit that bottom rung that you talked about and get them into a program. Is that a good approach to doing this?
Lars, I mentioned touch points, and that is a critical touch point. We want to catch people at everywhere along the spectrum and use every lever we have to try to help them recover. Some of the best and most successful programs in this country have been where the law enforcement community, the judicial community, and the public health community have combined to give people, as you mentioned, a choice and give them an incentive to go into care and to stay in care and have successful recovery. And so I completely am in favor of those types of partnerships and think we need more of them.
Do you like the job, sir?
I very much like the job. I'm very grateful that the president has given me this opportunity. It's a challenging time. And I tell you, having my own brother suffering from addiction, it's painful. But one of the saving graces is that I'm able to share my story and help lower stigma and hopefully create an environment where when he gets out of jail, he can be successful in long-term recovery.
Admiral Adams, it is a pleasure to have you on the program. Thanks so very much.
Lars, thank you for helping spread the word. It's critical. It's critical that more and more people know about what's going on and what they can do to help respond. And you're a part of that, so I appreciate it.
Glad to do it, sir. The Surgeon General of the United States, Vice Admiral Jerome Adams, you're listening to The Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to The Lars Larson Show. It frustrates me sometimes when I hear that governments seem to treat adult citizens like children. Here's a good example of it. Sound Transit, that's the big transit agency for the Seattle metro area. They had an escalator that broke down. Now, I work in a building where the escalator breaks down at least a few times a year, and it's not unusual. You have to take the elevator instead. Okay, that's fine. Well, apparently, to enter the University of Washington station, both downward escalators got stuck. Well, there's a simple solution. You turn off the power and you let people treat them like a big set of metal stairs. Oh, no, 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 no. The government does not trust you as a private citizen because I think they assume an awful lot of, you know, average folks, because you don't have a government job, probably aren't all that bright. So they had security guards stand there and tell people you're not allowed to take the escalator as a set of metal stairs, even though an escalator that's stuck, that doesn't have any electricity going to the motors or the motors aren't working, is just a set of metal stairs. So instead, people were forced to wait an extended period of time as all the people who would have flowed right down that escalator or walked down the stairs had to wait for the elevator. Now, of course, people who may have disabilities or they have a tough time with stairs, they can take the elevator anytime they want. But if the elevator's crowded with all these other people, because Sound Transit doesn't trust the average citizen to walk down a set of metal stairs. And if that makes sense to you, be a naysayer and call the show at 866-439-5277. Let's go to John in Bellingham, listening on KGMI. Hey, John, welcome to the program. What's on your mind?
Yes, Lars, I'd like to talk about the bomber in Austin. I think we need to set up some new anti-bomb laws. We need to make it illegal to possess, build, or blow people up with them, man. We need bomb confiscation right away.
I think that'd probably solve the problem, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, maybe we could have what do you think? How about a law against shooting heroin? If we only had a law that made heroin illegal, why, we wouldn't have 60,000 people a year dying from heroin overdoses, right?
That's right. If it was illegal, that guy would have never gone out and done that stuff.
Nope.
Crazy people and criminals always follow the law.
That's right. John, thank you very much for the call from Bellingham. KGMI got a little tongue stuck in his cheek on that one. You know about that bomber? We don't know a whole lot of him. We know his name. We know his age. We know he dropped out of school. We know he didn't have a job. He was unemployed, living with a couple of roommates. I have this feeling at this point, just with the small amount of data we have on this young man, this killer, who is now himself dead because he blew himself up, this Mark Anthony Condit. I think he may end up being a case a lot like the Las Vegas case and the killer in Las Vegas in this way. We still don't know what motivated the killer in Las Vegas. Lots of theories, lots of conspiracy theories, too, about that. But nobody's exactly sure why it why what happened in Las Vegas happened. And unfortunately, in this case, I hope they find something that helps us understand. For some reason, actually for a very human reason, I think all of us feel more comfortable with something if we find out why. Even if it doesn't change the ultimate outcome. If a friend of yours is involved in an automobile accident and is hurt, you say, why? If you hear, well, there was snow on the road, or he had a flat tire, whatever it is, you get some comfort from having some idea this happened because of a reason. In this case, I think this one may be as tough as Vegas. Let's go to naysayer Mike in Spokane. Hey, Mike, thanks for listening on KXLY. What's on your mind and where do we disagree? We got a minute to the break.
Well, a little bit of a disagreement. Those staircase, those riding staircase escalators do not meet the current code standards for commercial codes.
By one inch.
There you go. There's your problem. And also, because they've got the perforated edges, they are not considered a staircase. They are considered riding stairs only.
Have you ever walked up a stopped escalator?
Oh, I know. I do it all the time.
It sounds like you took your life in your hands.
I did, and you know, I did not trip on my way up, only three steps.
You didn't? Well, you're probably qualified to be a voter.
There you go.
I mean, I went and looked up the specs this morning. It is a one-inch difference. The typical escalator step is 8 inches. The typical, you know, regular code step is 7 inches. Do you think, Mike, do you think government could expect that thinking citizens, adults who are allowed out of the house without a note pinned to their vest telling where they're from and what their name is, that they might be able to handle that one-inch difference?
Oh, I'm sure we could, but we'd have to have counsel, and then we'd have to have the ADA, and we'd have to have all the other people.
You got the Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It is a pleasure to be with you on a Wednesday. Glad to get your phone calls and emails. And by the way, I'll be doing First Amendment Friday live with our affiliate KONA in the Tri-Cities of Washington on Friday. Tomorrow we'll be in studio, and then, of course, Monday back in studio as well. But it'll be great to go to the Tri-Cities, get a chance to visit with some folks and all. We're watching live a news conference. It's going on right now in Austin, Texas. And in fact, the representative from the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives is speaking about the bomber, Mark Anthony Condit, identified by the police as the man responsible for the deadly bombings dating all the way back to March the 2nd in Austin and in and San Antonio, at least one case, that led to deaths and critical injuries to people. Let's take a listen in for just a moment.
And so we had to address that. And our biggest concern was to make sure that nobody else gets hurt, whether it's first responders, whether it's the neighbors. So we apologize for any inconvenience. But our whole goal here was to make sure that we have no other people hurt in this investigation. We're not done with this investigation. It will continue. ATF, FBI resources will stay in town until we have completed and turned over every rock in this investigation. So we will not be leaving town, and we want to make sure there's no other devices out in the public. We have a reasonable level of...
All right, you've been listening to a...
All right, now that's what's going on in Pflugerville, Texas, just outside of Austin, Texas, about 20 miles away. Mark Anthony Condit, 23 years old, other reports said 24, lived in Pflugerville, Texas, was found at a hotel in Round Rock, Texas, this morning. Early this morning, the police were monitoring it, waiting for a specialized equipment to show up to allow them to approach him. He got into a car. He drove off. He went into a ditch off I-35 and then blew up his car as SWAT teams were approaching his car. The Austin bomber used the alias Kelly Kilmore. He also dressed in a wig at one point to drop off one of his bombs at a FedEx facility. And that FedEx package was going from Austin to a sorting facility in San Antonio, then to be delivered back to an address in Austin, Texas, before it went off. So we're going to keep an eye on that. We'll bring you more details as they become available. But they believe he was acting alone, that he had no accomplices. but that there could be other packages that he managed to mail or have caused to be delivered in whatever way before he finally blew himself up early this morning.
Yeah.
Let's go to Darren now. Darren, you heard me talking to the Surgeon General of the United States. He sounds like a very bright guy. You had something to say about what he was saying about heroin and opioids and overdose deaths in America.
Yeah, he was talking about the collaborative relationship that exists between providers and so forth. And as a provider in the greater Portland area, I just wanted to underscore the reality that this is an epidemic in our country. And providers such as my own that provides these services to people before it becomes life-taking is absolutely critical.
So now, Darren, so the audience is clear. You're a provider of treatment services for addiction, or you're a provider of pain medications?
Treatment services for those who are looking to get off of drugs and alcohol, yes.
Do you think that any of that treatment can, or that treatment is likely to be effective if the person who's being put into the treatment doesn't do it willingly?
Well, absolutely, Larry. You point to something that is true. They have to be ready to make that change. If they're not, you're just throwing good money at a situation that isn't going to change.
What's the best way to sort out those who are amenable to treatment and those who are, you know, you got to wait till they hit rock bottom before you're going to get to them, if you get to them at all?
That's true, but it does begin with conversations, such as the Attorney General was saying. It's frank conversations with people being willing to listen. And hope that through those conversations, it opens up a willingness and a desire to make some of those changes.
All right. Since you're in the treatment, I've been anxious to talk to some people in the treatment business. And, you know, strangely enough, some of them don't want to come on. So they're going to see how I treat you. And I hope they're more willing to come on the program. But Oregon and a lot of states have had a system where if you get arrested on a drug crime, that one of the ways you can avoid a felony conviction staying on your record is if you get into treatment. And I've been told by prosecutors, including my friend Josh Marquis, that when you tell a drug addict you're going to get a felony conviction, it's going to have an effect on you, or you could go into treatment, and if you stick with it for a year or two, we'll drop the felony charge, that was an effective way to get people in. And then Oregon decided, Washington hasn't done this, and Oregon, I think, stupidly said, we're going to decriminalize heroin and methamphetamine and cocaine possession and make it a misdemeanor instead of a felony. Now, we haven't had this in place long enough, I think, to see exactly what it's going to do. But you tell me from a treatment side, if they were able to push people into treatment by saying it's treatment or a felony, and now they don't have that anymore, are you going to get fewer people going into treatment because of that?
Well, certainly, Lars, that's a to have that hanging over one's head can be an impetus for change. And I can tell you that we have people that enter our program absolutely with that intention. But sometimes that is absolutely the wake-up call that they need. They realize that they need to make those changes. And so that can become a source of making that change for them. So, sometimes having a big stick is a helpful thing.
But what I'm asking you, Darren, is do you expect that now that they changed the law and said, hey, getting caught with heroin, meth, and cocaine is no longer a big deal, it's a misdemeanor, that you're going to see fewer people seeking treatment? Are you?
Yes, absolutely. I do think you could see that, absolutely, because now there's no motivation for change unless it truly comes from self. Sometimes it does have to take that motivating factor to get you there. But once you're in the door, you might realize, hey, I do have a problem and I do need to make that change.
Well, did the treatment community at all approach the governor and the legislature and say, don't do this? You're going to make it harder for us to get people into treatment. Or didn't you?
Well, I can't speak for my I can only speak for my own organization and say that, we have those kinds of conversations.
No, but did your organization, this is what I'm trying to, a definitive answer. Did your organization, say the head of your organization, how big is your treatment organization?
We have outfits all across the country.
Okay. Did the folks in charge of your company or your outfit call the governor and say, don't sign this bill and decriminalize these drugs because it's going to be harder to get people into treatment?
I know that we have partnered with organizations to sign those types of documents, yes.
Now, what does that mean?
What does that mean? That means that we do go on paper before legal representatives for the president's office on down to advocate for changes that help benefit treatment programs to get people off of drugs and alcohol.
And this hurt that effort. So apparently the governor did not listen to your organization or anyone else who is saying don't decriminalize these drugs.
I would think you're absolutely right, yes.
Wow. Okay. Any final words for, let's say you've got a family out there that's dealing with a son or daughter or other family member that's addicted to one of these drugs. What's the best way to push them into treatment or get them into treatment?
Well, as I mentioned, it does start with a conversation, and certainly knowing the resources that are available in your particular community. I know you broadcast all across the country. So knowing the resources that are within your community and being willing to have that available for when people are willing to say, I want to make that change.
I want to ask you something, though. How often do you ever hear a mom or dad say, we just sat down with our son or daughter, said, you can't be on this drug anymore, and they said, okay, I'll go into treatment?
Well, yeah, that's certainly a simplified approach, yes. And
does that ever work?
Sometimes it takes a long time.
Does that ever work? Really? I mean, the first time you sit down or second time or 10th time, because I hear from a lot of parents who are very frustrated by this. They say, I want to get my son or daughter help. And I say, but your son or daughter has to be willing to do it. And they say, well, we've talked to them 100 times and it doesn't do any good, I guess, until the person kind of hits the wall.
That is a true statement. It's not an easy answer, that's for sure.
Yeah, no doubt. If you had somebody come to you who's been addicted to heroin, coke, or meth for some period of time, I don't know what's typical, a year, couple of years, what's the minimum you'd consider to be a really effective treatment program? Is it a 30-day? Is it a 60-day? What is it?
The science would say 6 months to a year at minimum because you're dealing with deeper
inpatient
change.
Is it inpatient that whole time, or is it inpatient, or is it like 30, 60 inpatient and then another series of months out of facility?
Sure. Certainly, I'm responsible for a residential program, so of course I would advocate in that direction. Having a person away from their old places of habit, having an opportunity to embrace new change, new way of life, new relationships, that's only going to strengthen their chances of being clean and sober when they're reintroduced into a society. And that happens, obviously, through a gradual process. But certainly 6 months to a year is ideal to really scratch the surface of what's before them.
Hey, Darren, I'm not going to hold you to this, but in round numbers, what would 6 months in a treatment program like that cost?
An average for our program is about $3,000 per month per client. It's a pretty good chunk of change.
$20,000 or so to get 6 months of that kind of treatment.
Absolutely, yep.
Well, do you have a success rate that you can say?
Our success rate now is one of the higher ones nationally. That's the rate about 30%.
30%. I've heard 25 is really good, so 30 sounds even better. If people want to get a hold of your organization, I know you didn't expect a plug, but I don't mind giving a plug for the right reason. How would they reach your organization?
Well, they can call the Salvation Army Adult Rehabilitation Center. We have one here in Portland. We have others in Seattle. You can look us up online. We'd be happy to help people who are ready for change.
Darren, thanks very much for calling in.
And thank you for taking my call, Lars.
You bet. And you as well. Back in a moment. We're live on the Radio Northwest Network. We're glad to get your calls at 866-439-5277. Emails go to talk@larslarson.com. And when we come back, I want to tell you about a young lady who faced a life-threatening circumstance. And I think there were some people who might expect the police would have arrested her. But I'll tell you how this worked out well, even though she had to take, some serious action to protect her own life. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you here in the Pacific Northwest on the Radio Northwest Network. We're going to the Tri-Cities on Friday. We're going to do the First Amendment Friday edition of the program on Friday. And then I'll go to an event that night in the Tri-Cities and the next morning as well. And I might even get Tina to go with me. I told you there was a good result from a situation that we first told you about about a month and a half ago. Happened on February 8th. And when this first happened, I remember reserving judgment on what happened, because we had heard that a motorcyclist and a 60-year-old man in an automobile got into a dispute on the freeway. It was on I-5 near the King Pierce County line in Milton. Now we've learned more about it. We found out why, when the motorcyclist, who happened to be a young lady, was confronted by the man, the 60-year-old man in the car, he attacked her. He assaulted her. And here's the way it's described. They say he aggressively approached her on the shoulder of Interstate 5. This is from the prosecutor's office. He started a fight with the woman, and at some point she headbutted him. Jones then slammed the woman's head into a Jersey barrier and took her to the ground. As Jones tried to climb on top of her, she pulled out a gun and shot him in the chest. He died at the scene. The motorcyclist, who has a concealed pistol license, called 911 and waited for investigators. She was detained and then released after prosecutors made a decision. Jones' wife was a passenger and was not injured. This is another reminder for everyone to keep a cool head on the roads. I agree with that. But you do not take your vehicle and box somebody in and then approach them and attack them, even if this hadn't been a young lady. Instead, this young lady was able to protect herself, and you wonder how this might have ended up with the presumably larger man and smaller woman if she had not been able to protect herself with a great equalizer. Let's go to M, who's calling in. Hey, M, welcome to the Lars Larson Show.
Yeah.
Hi, M. What's on your mind?
Oh, I want to know about the when you go to the doctor and all this opiate stuff, that the doctor treats you like you're a drug addict and doesn't want to give you your pain medicine anymore. And but nothing, they can't give you anything else. And, you know, you've never been hooked on anything. You don't drink, you don't smoke, you know, and then you get treated like you're a drug addict.
That's insulting,
but
isn't it?
But like that?
How does the doctor know that you've never been an addict?
Because I've gone there for years.
I know, but there are lots of people who hide.
And they do blood tests. They do blood tests every year. You get a physical, you know.
They don't necessarily test for drugs. I don't think my last blood test tested me for heroin, cocaine, or meth, but they wouldn't have found any anyway. I mean, I'm not being facetious.
Well,
I think the doctors are under a lot of pressure to not prescribe opiates, because if they lose their license to prescribe, you know, their DEA license, because they have that on top of their medical license. If I'm wrong about this, a doc will call me up and tell me, then they're severely restricted if they don't have the ability to give pain pills to the people who legitimately need them. But they're getting squeezed hard by the Congress, by public pressure, by state legislature saying you folks are the problem. I don't think the doctors are the problem, frankly. I think street drugs are the problem. But having said that, I think
right.
The doctors are being pressured real hard. Do not give drugs out in large quantities. Don't and be suspicious about why people are seeking pain-killing drugs.
Okay, but what if you're on the smallest dose that there is? It's not likely that you're going to, it's not like that, like a drug addict would be even taking. It's like, you know, the smallest dose that you could get, and they're still treating you like that. And they want to give you all these other medicines that have all kinds of other side effects that don't cure what's wrong with you. They can't cure what's wrong with you. You go to medical doctors, and all they want to do is give you pills, you know, not opiates, but other pills that don't fix you. They don't cure anything. They just keep giving you pills and pills.
Opioids
and they give you all these side effects.
But opioids don't cure anything either, do they?
No, but it comes down that they can't give you anything else, and that's what it comes down to. A smallest dose of Vicodin, which is not like Oxycontin and stuff like that. You know, I've had different operations where I've had to take, you know, the Oxycontin for 6 weeks or whatever. I didn't get hooked
for
on it.
For 6 weeks?
So
that's a little unusual.
Like if you break your ankle,
mm-hmm.
you know, and they...
I think most docs give you a few days of Oxycontin and then say...
No, this was a few years back, like, you know, maybe 10, 8 years.
Yeah, well, I got to tell you something, Em. A few years back, the doctors wrote lots of prescriptions, some of them, and that was part of what helped create the problem. I appreciate the call, by the way. You've got the Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. Glad to be with you and glad to take your phone calls and your emails from around the Pacific Northwest. We supply honestly provocative talk to the Pacific Northwest, and I'm glad to be with you. 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Do you know, I find out something new, at least one thing new, almost every day doing this job. And I've been doing it for a long time, so you'd think that this would run down after a while, but no. I didn't realize, do you know when North Korea, that little crazy guy, Kim Jong-un, when he sets off a nuclear bomb, there is a, I guess, no longer secret lab that's tucked into a bunker in Newport, Washington. Okay, it's about, it's in the Colville National Forest. For 50 years, the scientists in this bunker out in the middle of the forest have all these instruments. So when you hear that they've set off a nuke in North Korea, and you think, well, we're probably watching on satellite. We probably are. We're probably listening to it with electronic instruments off the coast of North Korea. Yep, that's probably true as well. But in Newport, Washington, for 50 years, the site has served. This is from the Spokane Fish Wrapper. The site has served as the vital signs monitor, like on an emergency room patient. Since the planet is linked by a web of invisible electromagnetic, seismic, and infrared wave connections, a handful of monitoring sites in remote locations are used by scientists to record them. They say this allows them to watch and study hazards like nuke tests, earthquakes, tsunamis, and geomagnetic storms. It's located here for a reason, says Jeff Love, who's a senior scientist for the U.S. Geological Survey. They built the lab back in 1966. It's quiet, magnetically flat, and the data has been collected here for a long, long time. Well, I'm just geeky enough to want to go visit a place like that and see, how do they keep an eye on North Korea from a place near Spokane? Let's go to Bill in Kirkland. Hey, Bill, thanks for listening on Talk Radio 570. What's on your mind today?
Oh, yeah, thanks for having me, Lars. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, I hear you 5x5. What's up?
And I just want to say, I think I just caught the tail end of when you had, I think it was the Surgeon General on, but I was kind of surprised that that he was saying, correct me if I'm wrong, that he would, in essence, support lethal injection sites if, kind of on a state-by-state basis. I mean, I just find that so antithetical to what treatment is, which is not doing heroin, and certainly having babysitters watching people do heroin is just such a bizarre idea. I don't understand. I can't wrap my head around it. Maybe you can help me.
Well, listen, you know that I'm not a fan of safe injection sites, and you notice that while King County is still really enthusiastic about having safe injection sites, they haven't yet done it. You know, so they say, this is a great idea, but we're not ready to do it just yet. And then I think Pierce County has voted no on it. Snohomish County has voted no on it. I think most sensible communities would say, we're not doing that stuff. But King County thinks it's a great idea. So I'm not a fan of it. But if I had to make, I'm always capable of making the argument from the other side, the one I don't agree with. If I had to make that argument, I'd say, well, if people are going to shoot heroin, and we accept that that is the reality, there will be some people who shoot heroin, would you rather have them shoot it in an alley or somewhere else where if they overdose, they're going to die? Or would I rather have them shoot it somewhere where someone could apply Narcan and save their life? I'd rather have people stay alive. I'm in favor of life. I don't want people to die, except for, you know, serial killers and some drug dealers. In fact, Jeff Sessions has just told his prosecutors around America that the death penalty is on the table for the worst of the drug dealers. But having said that, I'm in favor of life. I take a position in favor of life, except for the death penalty and except for war and police officers who confront deadly threats to other people. So, but if I had to make the argument would be, if they shoot it someplace that's clean and safe and they put their needles in a sharps box, that's one little problem solved. If they don't die, that's a big problem solved. And that would be the argument in favor. I think, frankly, sending the message, it'd be like telling your kids not to drink, but if you're going to drink, drink here at home where mom and dad can keep an eye on you. And actually, that's state policy. It's state law in Oregon, Washington, and Idaho. If you want to feed your 12-year-old a beer, you can do it legally in your home. Now, if you do it to excess, you'll probably be accused of child abuse, but it's written right there in the law. So to some extent, you know, the laws we've operated under for alcohol are, you know, if you view a heroin addict as being somewhat like a child in the sense that they're not capable of controlling their own actions, they're addicted to something and being addicted to it means they're compelled to keep taking it, even if you tell them and they know that it's a bad thing for them. So if if I were going to be a contrarian, I'd say, well, if our policy is that it's better for kids to learn how to have a glass of wine or a beer at home in front of their parents where they can be watched and monitored and kept safe, then the same kind of argument goes for the safe injection sites. I don't like the idea of society saying it's illegal to take heroin, but if you decide to do it, we're going to help you do it. That, like you, I find that counterintuitive. It's crazy.
Well, you know, only 3% of the people up in Vancouver actually use the facilities, so most people are still doing it on the streets, you know what I mean?
Oh, well, and you know how the best proof is that they're still doing it on the streets? Go to a public park and look at the forest of needles that you can see in many places. There are reporters I know from TV who've said they've gone to, down to places by the waterfront in Portland where they literally find thousands of needles floating in the water. And you think, well, that's nice because somebody is going to step on one. You know, they're going to be walking on a beach next summer somewhere downriver, and their kid is going to step on that needle, and then you're going to have, you know, a few weeks of wondering whether your kid has hepatitis C or HIV.
Yeah, totally. Thanks for the call, Art.
Hey, it's my pleasure, Bill. Thanks for the call from Kirkland. Let me go to Marilyn, who's calling in from Gresham. Hey, Marilyn, thanks for listening on our flagship, FM News 101 KXL. What's on your mind?
Well, I told the gentleman that answered the phone that I had one question, and then I thought of another question that is very apropos to what you're just speaking about, the opiate thing.
Yeah.
If in the last 17 years, since we were run over by a large 18-wheeler semi-truck that was fully loaded.
Oh, no.
And my lower back was damaged a lot.
I'm sorry to hear that.
And so I ended, it's not been very good.
It sounds awful.
And so, I was on, now, first of all, I've had fibromyalgia since I was 32 years old. And I'm 69 and a half now.
Mm-hmm.
So it's been a long while. So I've been on pain meds for a long time. And so, but then after I had two different surgeries on my back, and I could not, and the pain just, it's like, my back just depreciated more every year, and it got so that I was so, I mean, I couldn't even walk anymore. My legs hurt so bad, and my back.
Marilyn, let me ask you this, though. Your case is atypical, right? It's not the typical case. The typical case is somebody has surgery, they've got pain, it's short-lived, they get a little bit of pain meds, and they're not on them indefinitely. What's the long-term prognosis for you? What is it that that you're suggesting we ought to do differently?
Well, what I did to completely get off all opioids without any side effects was my doctor at a pain clinic gave me a drug called topiramate. And that drug, I took it for a year, and after a year, I was off of a high dose of fentanyl and the opiates.
Sounds like a great solution, and it worked for you.
And it worked wonderfully without one other problem. And it, you know, see, I've had so much pain in that. I've never gotten a high off of anything because I needed it for pain. And so, but it took me a year, but I got off of it and I was so pleased. I mean, I could have kissed him.
You should be pleased. That's a really tough thing to do. Marilyn, I appreciate the call. We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. Our Twitter poll today brought to you by Ultimate Truck Service. If you rely on trucks for your business, keep your biggest assets on the road and running right. Online at ultimatetruckservice.com. Our question today, when government agencies that fail children have to pay out millions in settlements, should somebody at the agency get fired? My answer to that would be yes. Yesterday, we asked you, should school cops be removed from schools as one teachers union is suggesting? 94% of you joined me in voting no. Only 6% said yes. By the way, tonight, I'm doing left hook, right jab with my liberal, counterpart, if you will, Steve Novick. That's on Channel 8. Apparently, we're near the top of the show in the 6 o'clock hour. Why? Because we're talking about what advice we would have to those young men and women who staged all those walkouts from school that I thought wasted a lot of time and resources. And on Friday, not tomorrow, tomorrow I'm in studio. On Friday, I'll be on remote at the Moore Mansion in the Tri-Cities with my friends from KONA. Glad to be there for First Amendment Friday and for a couple of events that are going on there. Let's go to Naysayer Mike in Medford listening on KMED. Hey, Mike, welcome to the program. Where do you and I disagree?
Well, a couple of things, but certainly not on your question of the day, because there is no accountability in government. I don't care what level it is. I don't care if it's the school board, the city, the county, the state, the feds, the water district. Forget it.
No accountability, but in the private sector, there's usually accountability. I mean, look at this. I was just carping to my producers. I was saying, I don't particularly like Facebook. I don't particularly like Zuckerberg's politics. But his company gathers data and sells the data. That's what they do. They also run some advertising, but they also sell data to people. Nobody who's got a brain, you know, thinks that these big internet companies are not gathering data. And there's nothing especially evil about it if you consent to give your data to them. And all of a sudden, he's being forced to be accountable. I think the stock price of Facebook dropped about 10% over the last couple of days, which is billions of dollars. Why? Because all of a sudden, somebody realized, hey, they're using the data. Well, duh. But in the government, you can be working at the White House and leak information out about the president's personal conversations with the leader of Russia, and apparently nobody gets fired.
Okay, well, I don't know how long we have to talk about this, but usually it's not very long. So let me get to
it. Let's just get to it.
Because you're going to cut me off any second.
Well, you're wasting daylight right now, but go ahead.
The Surgeon General, he is just spouting the liberal talking points on this drug addiction thing. The guy just makes me sick.
What liberal talking points?
It is not a disease because you get to choose whether you use or not. If it's a disease, then every other compulsive behavior is a disease, whether it's alcoholic or child molester, because they're all just compulsive behaviors. So the other thing that was totally ridiculous is the part about offering people treatment. When you offer people treatment instead of going to jail, yeah, they take the treatment because they don't want to go to jail.
Right.
But the problem is they don't really choose the treatment on their own. They can just go through the treatment and then reoffend in another year and a half or 2 years and then go back into treatment. It's called drug court. And it's just a kangaroo court. It's a whole industry based on servicing these drug addicts.
It is, but so, I guess what I'd ask you for is, you know, it's like Franklin said, what when the lady asked him, what kind of government did you give us? Republic, if you can keep it. And when people say it's less than perfect, right, you say, great, but it's the best system we've found so far. What system would you use to address this problem?
I'm getting to that.
I hope so.
So for the first 300 years in this country, 1620 to 1920, you could do whatever the hell you wanted as long as you didn't harm another person or their property. 165 years ago, we had an opioid epidemic during the railroad building years when the Chinese came over as labor and they brought it with them. Except the people that used it, they died because the only social service safety net was your family or your church. And if you burned those two bridges, you were SOL down the river. So if we quit enabling this, if it becomes socially unacceptable, because right now it's socially acceptable to be a drug addict.
Unfortunately, true.
There's a ton of treatment for you, but look at these two examples. Number one, take the drug situation. And then I can't remember the example you brought up, but look at what's happened in Hollywood with the casting couch, which we all know was part of the culture there forever and ever. Now, all of a sudden, it's socially unacceptable, and you lose everything you ever worked for if somebody even accuses you of sexual harassment. That's how you treat this.
is that you simply say, let the chips fall where they may. If you decide to be addicted to a drug that's potentially deadly and you die, then that's a natural consequence. And if you want to quit on your own, go down to, you know, Al-Anon or to AA, and you can quit if you choose to.
Sure. What if we outlawed Narcan and nobody got saved? They'd only overdose once. But these people overdose over and over again, and somebody else is saving their ass.
That's true.
It doesn't make any sense. We're paying for it. It's just like all the people in prison. Capital punishment, here we go. If the penalty doesn't outweigh the crime, there is no deterrent.
And when you do have a penalty like capital punishment that does outweigh the crime, then, or at least equals the crime, you find that people are deterred from that kind of behavior to a considerable extent. My good naysayer, thank you very much. You're listening to the Radio Northwest Network and the Lars Larson Show.